And the speaker at the conference was Lieutenant General Daniel Graham, who was Ronald Reagan's Star Wars chief. And during the question and answer period, someone raised their hand and said, "General Graham, aren't you worried about that demonstration in New York today? They say there's almost 1 million people there protesting against nuclear weapons." He said, "No, I think it's fantastic. They're out there protesting against ICBMs, and we're moving into space, and they don't have a clue. Let them keep doing what they're doing." And it was in that moment that I reverted back to my old cowboy and Indian movie training days. Head them off at the pass. You remember that? It was in that moment that I said to myself, "My God, I got to learn about this." And that's when I began working on space issues. And because of the presence of the Space Center in my state in Florida, where I lived at that time, I lived there 30 long, long, torturous years. I began working on that issue, and I began taking people to the Space Center over and over and over and over again. As we learned about how the military had taken over the space program, we were a little bit late because, as it turned out, and it's in the video back there on the table, we tell the story about how when the Nazis were brought to this country after the war with 100 copies of the V-2 rocket that Hitler used to terrorize the cities of London and Paris and Brussels with, along with 100 members of Wernher von Braun's rocket team, they created the U.S. space program. But with them, they also, I believe, brought an ideological contamination. Because it wasn't just 100 of the rocket guys that were brought over from Hitler's Germany. Altogether, there were 1,500 of the top Nazi operatives. The former Nazi intelligence that were brought to America to create the CIA. And then there were the Nazis that were taking Jews and putting them in freezing temperatures to find out how the body would react. And they were brought over to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio to create the flight medicine program for the United States. And so throughout the military-industrial complex of America, we had a seeding of 1,500 top Nazi operatives. And so I suggest to you that there was an ideological contamination of the military-industrial complex. And when we look at Eisenhower's warning to us at the end of his administration and his concluding speech to the American people, when he tried to tell us to beware of the power of the military-industrial complex, I like to believe that he was sending us a coded warning, that he was seeing something very dangerous that was happening within the military-industrial complex, that there was an ideological brew being concocted that has now come to flourish today. And so as we look at the vision for 2020 of the Space Command, where they do indeed talk about how the United States will control and dominate space, and how we will deny other countries access to space. Where is that coming from? You know, when Christopher Columbus was sent by Queen Isabella of Spain to find the New World, he came back and he said, "Oh, yes, yes, I found it." And the first thing that Spain did was the 100-year program of creating the Spanish Armada. It took them 100 years to create the Spanish Armada. And the job of the Spanish Armada was to go out into the New World to protect the interests and investments in the New World. Because Columbus came back and said, "Look, there are plate lands where you can't imagine the bounty of them." And so, of course, Spain wanted to control the resources and the markets that would emerge in these new worlds. And this created the global war system. As soon all the other European countries, Italy and England and France and others, built their own navies because they wanted to compete with each other to control the new worlds. And they were soon slitting each other's throat, creating the global war system that we still suffer from today. Well, this is the vision for 2020. And in here, they mention this. Under a section called the historical perspective, historically, military forces have evolved to protect national interests and investments, both military and economic. During the rise of sea commerce, nations built navies to protect and enhance their commercial interests. During the westward expansion of the continental United States, military outposts and the cavalry emerged to protect our wagon train settlements and railroads. Likewise, they say, space forces will emerge to protect military and commercial national interests and investments in the space medium due to their increasing importance. So as gold is discovered on the asteroids, and magnesium and cobalt and uranium are discovered on Mars, you've been told that we're going to Mars to look for the origins of life so that we might better understand where we as a people come from. But those two little rovers today on Mars driving around, powered by plutonium, you didn't know that probably, they're doing soil identification and soil sampling. And the previous Mars orbiter missions are doing mapping of the surface. They're doing geological fact finding of Mars so that someday they can go and mine the planet. And Halliburton, today, Halliburton is working on a drilling mechanism for Mars. These people are planning ahead. There's a document, a congressional study commissioned by the Congress of the United States. It's called Military Space Forces, the Next 50 Years. Congressional staffer John Collins asked to write the definitive study for Congress. How's this whole thing going to work? In his report to the Congress, the foreword of the book, signed by John Glenn, former astronaut senator from Ohio, Bill Nelson was the congressman from Cape Canaveral, went up on the shuttle one time. He's now the U.S. senator from Florida. They all signed, others as well, other politicians, signed the foreword of the book. This is wonderful. This is fantastic. It's really a seminal document. Well, in there, the author tells Congress that with U.S. bases on the moon and with armed space stations on either side of the moon, the United States would be able to control what he called the Earth-Moon gravity well. He says, think of it like a wishing well. Imagine someone is down inside the bottom, but you're at the top. You put a lid on it, they can't get out, right? Or if you control the front gate of a base, you control who gets on and off the base. Well, he said, with our armed forces lying in wait at that location, we could hijack rival shipments upon return. Piracy. We, the United States, will control and dominate space. We will deny other countries access to space. And when the day comes when we can successfully mine the sky, the aerospace industry, through the Space Command, will patrol the friendly skies and determine who can get on and off the planet Earth and who can make profit in the heavens. And so I realized that the Space Command's job is not only to give the Pentagon control and domination of the planet Earth for the benefit of the multinational corporations, but its job is also going to be to create a parallel highway, a military patrolled, controlled highway between the Earth and the planetary bodies in the next 100 years, so that the United States military, working to the benefit of the multinational corporations, the military industrial complex, that they will be able to control the shipping lanes. And so that's what we're dealing with today. I didn't always think like this. I grew up in a military family, an Air Force family. And in 1968, at 16 years old, I was working on the Nixon campaign up in the panhandle of Florida, just where the hurricane just hit up there, Fort Walton Beach, Eglin Air Force Base. My dad was stationed there. I was a young Republican for Nixon, vice chair of the Okaloosa County, Florida Young Republican Club. And I did such a good job working on the Nixon campaign. One of my high school teachers told me, "You're the reason I voted for Richard Nixon." Can you believe that? And so I did such a good job. They had this big fish fry fundraiser for Nixon. And they invited me to sit at the head table with the guest speaker that evening. You probably heard of the guy, recently died, Senator Strom Thurmond from South Carolina. So that's how I got my start in politics. And then in 1971, I tried to join the Air Force because I wanted to be a career man. And I flunked my induction physical, actually, because of an old high school football injury. So I had to get a waiver to get into the military when most people were trying to get out. By this time, we had moved to Beale Air Force Base in Northern California. That is where the SR-71, the black spy plane, was stationed. And as it turned out, my father was working on the cameras, the spy cameras on the plane, and photo reconnaissance, it's called. And I flunked my physical, so I had to get a waiver to get in at the Oakland Induction Center. And after my training, my first base, I was sent to Travis Air Force Base. There was an airlift base for the war in Vietnam. And the first day I checked into the barracks, they looked down this clipboard and said, "Oh my God, we've only got one room left. I'm sorry about that. We'll get you out of there as soon as we can. Get your bags." And we walked down this long, dark hallway, and they kept saying to me over and over again, "Really, we'll get you out of here as soon as we can." And he opened the door, and we walked in, and there were anti-war posters all over the wall. As it turned out, it was the room of the leading GI resistance movement organizer in the barracks. And they were keeping him isolated because they wanted to kick him out. But they had run out of rooms. And then they forgot about me. And so at night, there was a knock on the door, and white guys would come in with chairs and sit in a circle talking about the war. And I sat in a corner because I thought they were communists. And they were smoking pot. Now, I had heard of it before, and I promise you, I never inhaled, not one time. I never did. And then another night, there was a knock on the door, and black guys came in with chairs, and they sat in a circle, and these were Black Panthers from the cities talking about racism. And again, I thought they were communists, and I sat in the corner. It could have been the marijuana in the room. I inhaled it unknowingly, unconsciously, but eventually my chair moved into the circle. And my life was changed forever. And on the weekends, yeah, you can clap, that's fun. On the weekends, almost every weekend, outside the gate, about 10 or 12 lonely little protesters with their sign. Can you hear them now? Do you think it does any good? You think anyone's paying any attention? There's only 10 or 12 of us here today. Do you think we'll ever change anything? Well, little did they know that we had 15,000 permanently stationed GIs on our base, in addition to all the thousands that came and went on the airplanes from Vietnam, and that we would talk about them in the chow hall, on the job, in the barracks. And they helped my transformation. So I'm a total believer in going to the bases and to the weapons facilities, because in that process, we reach people who are doing the job. And if we can get them to reflect and change, soon enough, some of them, I promise you, will come and join us. I know it because I've seen it in my own life. And so with that in mind, I want to invite you to go to Vandenberg Air Force Base on Saturday, September 25th at 1 o'clock. Helen Caldicott's going to be there. People are coming from around the region. And this is the first day of what we call Keep Space for Peace Week, an international week where our friends around the world hold hands symbolically to say, we don't want to move the arms race into heaven. And I'm proud to say this year, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom is co-sponsoring our Keep Space for Peace Week and helping us organize this all over the world. And let me tell you about some of the people and some of the places that will be holding events during this week. Up in northern England, Yorkshire, beautiful, beautiful rolling hills and sheep grazing. And there, as you come over the crest of a hill, you see these ugly monstrosities, these big round golf ball looking things. They're called radoms. And what it is, it's what's called a downlink facility. They have about 15 or 20 of these big ungodly looking things sitting there. And their job is to intercept all phone, fax, and email communications from throughout Europe as the United States spies on the people of that region, intercepting all communications. And now this place is being upgraded for participation in Star Wars. And one of our friends, Lindis Percy, who's a local Quaker and a nurse and a midwife, has been arrested about 100 times at this place because she keeps climbing the fence. She keeps going in, and her and other women over the years have actually gone into the buildings at night and removed documents and are able to prove that this is one of the United States' key installations that will help direct Star Wars. Because as satellites orbit the Earth, they send their signals down to the Earth below where they are at the time. And so the United States has had to set up these facilities all over the planet that help communicate and direct with Star Wars. And they're all being upgraded. The radar facility at Beale Air Force Base, one of the key radars in this whole infrastructure. There's one on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. There's one in Darmstadt, Germany, and our friends are organizing to resist it there. There's one out in the middle, 1,500 kilometers out in the bush country in Australia called Pine Gap, and our friends in Australia are organizing that. Now, for them to go to a demonstration, it takes them 2 days. But they do it. And so all over the world, there are now people like us that are saying, hey, look, we don't want our communities to be part of Star Wars, to be part of giving the United States control and domination of the planet and outer space as well. And so this is who we all are. And in 1992, we created the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space because we saw that this thing was getting bigger than a bread box. All right? And we needed an organizational apparatus that would allow us to educate people all over the world. And so that's what Keep Space for Peace Week is about. Helping us every year, little by little, expand the consciousness of the people around the planet. So when they go out at night and they look at the moon and they look at the stars, they begin to see it in a whole new way. You know, after I was organizing fruit pickers, from then on, every time I saw an orange tree, I saw ladders and workers and tubs and guys with emphysema going up and down the ladder who were 65 and shouldn't have been working, but they were working because they were black. You know what I'm saying? I began to see it all very differently. And so as we begin to educate people about what the plans are for space, they too will begin to see things differently. And that's our job. I want to talk to you for a minute about Bush's current plans. You know that before the election, he's already begun the process of deploying so-called missile defense interceptors at Vandenberg and at Fort Greely in Alaska. The elementary stages of quote-unquote Star Wars. Well, first of all, we know that they don't work because the testing program has not been working. In fact, they just canceled a test the other day, the third cancellation in a row, because they're terrified that they might do a test before the election, before the deployments, and it won't work. It'll make the thing look like the sham that it is. But I want to talk to you about this so-called national missile defense. The idea of having a bullet hit a bullet in deep space to protect the continental United States from attack by the rogue states. Remember, Iraq was going to attack the United States with WMD, but come to find out they don't have any. Iran is going to attack the United States with WMD, but they don't have any. North Korea is going to attack the United States with WMD, but they don't have any. But guess who's got a whole bunch of WMD? We do. I would submit to you that this idea of missile defense is a Trojan horse. It has absolutely nothing at all to do with defense. That's just the sales pitch. It's about controlling space, it's about dominating space, and it's about denying other countries access to space. In fact, at the Space Command Headquarters building in Colorado, Peterson Air Force Base, on their building they have their slogan that reads, "Master of Space," and they wear it as a patch on their uniform. We're going to be the masters of space. Deutschland über alles. Okay? It's not about defense at all. So it doesn't matter that the testing program doesn't work. It doesn't matter that these missile defense interceptors aren't going to work, because it's not about defense in the first place, and they know it. It's about offense. It's about control and domination. And it's about using missile defense, scaring the people, getting the people to think, oh yeah, we got to protect ourselves from WMD, from the rogue states. Sure, go ahead and take the national treasury, no problem. We've got to scare people, because in that process, we then are able to tap into the treasury over a multi-generational period of time that will allow then to build the offensive systems that are underway. That's the real key. Look at the research and development dollars. When a Democratic politician comes to you and says, "I'm opposed to the deployment of national missile defense," they're not giving you much, because number one, there's nothing to deploy, really. But what you really want to look is how they voted on the annual appropriations for research and development. And guess what? I'll tell you a little story. Reagan and Bush, they had SDI, you remember that? And then Clinton won. And Clinton held a press conference. "I'm getting rid of SDI. $3.5 billion a year at that time for research and development. It's shut down." And my friends in the peace movement began, "Bruce, why are you still working on Star Wars? Clinton has closed down SDI. The $3.5 billion is gone." But what my friends didn't know, because they didn't follow it all the way through, was that then Clinton created a new organization quietly called BIMDO, the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization. And he moved the 3.5 from SDI into BIMDO, and they kept doing what they were doing before. And every year it got more and more and more and more money. And the Republicans and the Democrats were approving more and more and more research and development spending for BIMDO. And then George W. comes into office, and he renames it MDA, Missile Defense Agency. And now it's up to $10 billion a year, research and development. Republicans and Democrats together supporting the money. Democrats saying, "Let's don't rush deployment, friends." But there's nothing to deploy yet. So it's a safe position to take. But that's just the $10 billion for missile defense. You know, all these satellites that coordinate warfare, the entire Iraq war coordinated by 50 satellites on the radar screens at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado, those satellites are in another budget, NRO, NSA, $20 billion a year, new generations of satellites for Star Wars. So add that to your 10. Now we're up to 30. Then you got NASA. NASA's been taken over by the Pentagon. NASA's every mission, according to the head of NASA, Sean O'Keefe, former Secretary of the Nuclear Navy. Bush appointed him. His first press conference, everything we do at NASA from now on will be dual use, meaning every mission will be both military and civilian at the same time. So add NASA money into this. Then Department of Energy, who's building the nuclear rocket. The nuclear rocket, Project Prometheus, with nuclear reactors and nuclear mining colonies on the moon and Mars in the future, and nuclear-powered rovers driving around. Nuclear power in space. Why do we need nuclear power in space? Well, come to find out, we've discovered in various Pentagon documents, the Pentagon is saying, in order to fire a laser through space, we need massive power projection capabilities. In other words, we can't run an extension cord from here on up to the heavens. So nuclear reactors, the Pentagon has been saying for some time, are the only known compact source able to supply military space forces with the kind of multi-megawatt power we're going to need. That's a quote right out of John Collins's Military Space Forces the Next 50 Years report to the Congress. We've got to have nuclear reactors to power the weapons in space. So that's DOE budget. So you add that money in. And so before you know it, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, about $80 billion. And don't forget the black budget, the secret Pentagon budget that some people say conservatively is about $20 billion a year, most of it going into space weapons development at the Skunk Works here in California and other places where they're doing this secret Pentagon spend, Pentagon research and development. So we're talking some real cash now, friends. We're talking some big money. And so where's that money going to come from? Is George Bush going to raise taxes on the rich in order to pay for all this stuff? Well, a few years ago, I discovered an article, actually it was an op-ed, in Space News, the industry publication, an op-ed where they were talking about where the money should come from. And they said, there's plenty of waste, fraud, and abuse in the entitlement programs. And we are going to train our lobbyists on that. And that is the place we're going to extract the funding for our space plans. Now, let's just, for a moment, dissect what these entitlement programs are. Entitlement programs are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of welfare. And now, under the Clinton welfare reform, in your entire life, you can only draw welfare for 4 years. After that, you're finished, you're on the street, you're to the poorhouse. Those are the programs that the aerospace corporations have identified that they are going to defund in order to pay for these space programs. I call it pyramids to the heavens. The aerospace industry are the new pharaohs of our age, building these pyramids to the heavens. And we, the taxpayers, will be the slaves. We will turn over literally everything. Our children's education, environmental cleanup, the entitlement programs. We will turn that over to them and get virtually nothing in return except instability. Bush is now, in addition to his national missile defense deployments, he's now pushing for the testing of the first offensive weapon systems in space. And so this is the direction they're now heading, moving forward with it. Recently, the Pentagon has been complaining that during our shock and awe bombing of Iraq, Iraq had the audacity to try to interfere with our satellite communications via kind of computer technology, just to kind of block, if you will, through, you know, kind of computer dipsy doodles, some of our ability to maneuver. And the Pentagon is furious about it. And the Pentagon is walking around today saying, we told you there would be a Pearl Harbor against our satellites, and Iraq has done it. They have attacked our satellites, and this is an indication that we now must come forward with offensive systems in space so that we can deny other countries access to space by removing their satellites in times of hostilities. So this is what the Pentagon is using today to create the political support in Congress to go forward with offensive weapon systems tests in the heavens that will blow the doors off the barn. Now, at the United Nations, for the past several years, Canada and Russia and China have introduced resolutions calling for a global ban on weapons in space. Close the door to the barn before the horse gets out. And the United States, Clinton, during the Clinton years and now the Bush years, has taken identical position. There is no problem. Therefore, there's no need to negotiate a global ban on weapons in space. There are no weapons in space today. This is why Bush walked away from the ABM treaty as soon as he came in the office with Russia, because it limited the amount of testing and deployment of so-called missile defense systems. The Missile Defense Agency has just in recent days begun advertising an environmental impact statement for their expanded plans in the coming period. They're going to be holding hearings in very strange places, in Hawaii and Alaska, in Virginia, and in Sacramento. Now, why in God's name, when they're deploying down in Vandenberg, are they going to hold hearings up in Sacramento? But that's what they plan to do next month, begin these hearings. So it's going to be a good time for people to write letters. In a few days, we're going to have on our website all the information about who you can write to and what you should say, those kinds of things. But it's also a good time for people to begin writing letters to the editor during the next month, talking about this is a colossal waste of money. This is going to create a whole new arms race that will only benefit the weapons corporations and is going to create massive global instability. So I hope all of you will try to help write a letter around this particular subject. You know, in case no one noticed, America has a massive fiscal crisis right now. I know in California, your economy is just humming right along. Your state has no problems whatsoever. And I don't know what all that talk about girly men is about, but it doesn't have anything to do with your economy, I'm sure. Well, you know, recently, thank God, I moved out of Florida just in time. Because I think God has become angry at the Bush family. And all these hurricanes, you know. But just the other day, I heard on the national news, someone, oh my God, they'll probably lose their job over this, but someone on the national news said this. Well, they asked this question, where is the money going to come from to clean up all these hurricanes? I'm sure they're going to lose their job. But anyway, the answer was, oh, well, they're going to have to borrow the money because we're in a massive debt, and where are we going to get the money otherwise? So the future generations, on top of everything else, are now going to be paying for the cleanup of the hurricanes. And so at this time, when we have this widening gap between rich and poor in America, we know that 29,000 people at the top of the pyramid in America have the equivalent wealth of 96 million at the bottom. 29,000 at the top have the equivalent wealth of 96 million Americans at the bottom. And so at this moment, when we have such a tremendous national fiscal crisis, is not the time to be undertaking what the Pentagon says will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth, Star Wars. Well, you know, before long, virtually the only jobs left in America are going to be working for the Pentagon, right? I mean, what's the number one industrial export in America today? That's right. Not shoes, refrigerators, or weapons. And when weapons are your number one export, what's your global marketing strategy? That's right. The more wars, the better. The more weapons you sell. You remember that little EP3 spy plane incident with China a couple years ago. It was bumping up along the coast, and the Chinese brought it down to Hainan Island. And then they took it apart and sent it home in boxes. You remember that? Come to find out, today on Hainan Island, Lockheed Martin, the same company that built the EP3 spy plane, is now building a naval reconnaissance system for Communist China on Hainan Island. Now get that. They're working both sides of the street. Yeah. So that's where we are today. Well, and so the military's job today then is not to defend America from attack by who. The military's job today is to go out and prepare. It's like gardening. It's to go out and prepare the soil for corporate globalization. The job of the Pentagon today is to become the military arm of corporate globalization. And that's why we're going to have, in their vision, endless war. Well, the other night I was watching C-SPAN, just 2 weeks ago. It was late at night, and they had this guy on from the Naval War College. He was talking to a room full of officers from all the different services, majors, colonels, stuff like that. And the subject was military in the 21st century. Did any of you see this? The guy's name is Barrett. Well, he really laid out the vision, and it was chilling. And I want to share some of it with you. The new Pentagon vision. He said that what we, the United States, our role in the world in the coming period is going to be the security export leader. What we are going to export to the world, we're going to export security. Not just weapons, but security export, he defined. And what that meant was troops. Troops. Our number one export to the world will be troops. To go into what he defined as the gap. The gap is the part of the world that is not taking kindly to corporate globalization. And he defined it, the Middle East, Central Asia, parts of Latin America, and Central Africa. We, in the coming period in the United States, will export security into the gap in order to allow the corporate globalists to control the regions. And if you really look closely at these gap areas, what you find is they are the remaining parts of the world that have oil. He went on to say, talking about Iraq, that in Iraq, we were bad. We went in there and they wouldn't even fight us. Our military was so bad, they ran. We are so tough, nobody in this world can take us on. But, he said, we're not doing the second part very well, the occupation. We're having a bit of trouble with the occupation. And he said, we've got to learn to do this occupation right, because if we're going to pull this off, security export in the coming years, we're going to have to learn how to do occupation, because that's going to be our job in the gap. That's what America is going to do. China, he said, is going to make cars. They're going to make SUVs that are going to sell for $15,000. And this country is going to do this, and this country is going to do that, and the United States, we're going to do security export. So he said we have to transform the military so that they get better, they get a better capability to carry out this new function. And he defined his restructuring concept. And the job of the officers in the audience was to take this back into their various branches of the services and to begin to indoctrinate the lower levels of the military in these new concepts. And he said, if you want to be promoted in the future, if you hope to advance in the coming military, you got to learn this script. So for me, it was another moment like 1982 when I'm listening to, oh, don't worry about it, we're moving into space, and they don't have a clue. So I was taking notes fast. And let me give you the two pieces to the puzzle that I think are the most important. He says, instead of the Army, Navy, and the Air Force, and the Marines, we got to have Leviathan, and we got to have SysAd. These are the two branches of the military that we have to do. Leviathan and SysAd. Leviathan, he said, is this. Give me your young 18, 19, and 20-year-old angry kids that love to play video games. Give me them. They're going to be our kick-ass Leviathan army that is going to go in and wipe out opposition in the gap. And then after they've succeeded, we get them out of there. And then we bring in SysAd, Systems Administration. Systems Administration, he said, we want more mature people, older people, more diverse people, women, people of color, more educated people, because they're going to be the proconsul of the empire. And their job is going to be to administer the corporate globalist empire. And so they need to be more sophisticated. And right now, we don't have that, he said. And he said, they will never come home. They will never come home. And so today, if you've heard the Bush administration announce that we're closing down some of the big bases in Europe, and we're going to close down some of the 40,000 troops in South Korea, and we're going to begin to establish new, what are called lily pad bases. Lily pad bases, all in the gap regions. Little jumping off bases where we don't even have to stay very long. We set up infrastructure, and then we can just jump from one to the next and put out fires when we need to so that we can control the gap regions in the coming period. And all of this will be tied together because this is a massive undertaking of deployments and listening and watching and targeting. All of it will be tied together by space technology. It's the only way it can work is with space technology. Space technology that allows you to listen, intercept all phone, fax, and email communications around the world. Satellite technology that allows you to see everything all the time. Satellite technology that allows you to fly little UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, pilotless planes, flying over Iraq, flying over Palestine, coordinated by computers, people sitting at computer screens. Yes, we see it. Is it Taliban? Is it Al-Qaeda? Is it a wedding? Hit the button. The UAV outfitted with weapons called the Predator fires in real time, split second time, hitting targets on the ground, coordinated back all the way back to Tampa, Florida, and MacDill Air Force Base. It's called increasing the kill chain. That's the plan for the future. And our friends around the world are saying, we don't want these bases in our communities. We don't want to be complicit in our own repression. And we will resist the United States Empire. And then they say to me, what's going on in the United States? What are the American people thinking? What are the American people doing? Do they know about these things? And I say, well, you know, we got some great peace activists in the United States. Look right here in Santa Cruz. You all are on fire. You're great. And there are people like you all over this country, as you know, who are working their hearts out. But we got one problem in America, one real big problem. And it's we are a violent culture. If you look at the fabric of America, think of it as a cloth. Think of the weaving together of America, the cloth of America. From the very first days when Columbus came to the shores and killed the Indians when they didn't have gold, chopped off their hands and arms and legs and killed them because he thought they were lying to them because they surely had gold. And then the extermination of Native American people. I want to read to you just a paragraph. I really felt guilty as I applied the torch to huts that were homes of content, until we ravagers came spreading desolation everywhere. Our mission here is ostensibly to destroy, but may it not transpire that we pillagers are carelessly sowing the seeds of empire. Now, who is that saying that? It was a soldier, a veteran from George Washington's army in 1779 that was sent out to remove the Iroquois civilization from New York. As Washington pushed the boundaries of the new American empire westward to the Mississippi River. So from the very first days, the first weaving together of this nation was violent, was genocidal. And then what followed, of course, was the introduction of slavery in America. And then followed that, the stealing of massive portions of lands from Mexico. And then what followed on and on out into the Philippines and today where we are in Iraq. The creation of the American empire was done through a bloody cloth. It is inside of every one of us. We are a killer society, a society of killers. AP reported July 16th from Iraq, Captain Will Hickok VI, a relative of the famous Wild Bill, stationed in Iraq with the Army's elite 9th Cavalry Unit, saying this: "This is what I like, just scouting, sitting out here spying, watching. It's relaxing. It's almost like cowboys and Indians." So there we are today, our country. My name is America, and I'm addicted to war. My name is America, and I'm addicted to violence. My name is America, and I'm addicted to military spending. My name is America, and my Congress is under the control of the military-industrial complex. You know, back in the 80s, following on the, it was a natural progression from the freeze, we moved into the economic conversion movement. With the dissolution of the Soviet Union, we all were talking about the peace dividend. Now's the time. Now we can go and convert the military-industrial complex. But along came King George I, Bush I, and he invaded Panama to go after that one bad guy, remember? Manuel Noriega, the former CIA agent. And we went in and we bombed the entire El Chorrillo neighborhood, killing over 2,000 innocent civilians, burning it to the ground. Why? Because that's what we do. That's the way we are. And then the Persian Gulf War, where we had to go and chase out another bad guy, another ex-CIA agent called Saddam Hussein. And you remember the famous Road to Basra, the highway of death, where we killed numerous people fleeing back into Iraq. And out of that, though, came the end of the talk about economic conversion and the end of the talk about the peace dividend, because now we had a new enemy in Iraq. And during the Clinton years, we kept after that enemy. We kept dropping cruise missiles, and we kept that no-fly zone, and we kept our planes over there, and we built bases in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain, in Kuwait, and the military-industrial complex kept humming along. Whether it was Republican or Democrat, it just kept humming along. Our economy was benefiting from all this military spending. And there we are today. Well, I think if the peace movement ever wants to succeed, we're going to have to end the military-industrial complex. We're going to have to put economic conversion economic conversion has to come back onto the table. Because we could stop the Iraq war tomorrow. And I promise you that within a year or so, we'll have another hot war because we've got to keep the assembly lines moving and humming again to keep the jobs going. Now, where I live in Maine, there are all these textile mills all along the Androscoggin River and the other rivers in the state, these old, beautiful brick mills where they used to make textiles and make shoes. They're all closed down. They're all gone. And the two top employers in the state of Maine today, number one is Bath Ironworks that builds the Aegis destroyers that is being outfitted with theater missile defense systems and is going to be parked off the coast of China in order to provoke China to build more nuclear weapons. And then the second top employer in the state is the Brunswick Naval Air Station where I live in Brunswick. And it's now flying reconnaissance and surveillance missions over Iraq, calling in airstrikes. These EP-3 spy planes, they're based there in Brunswick where I live. Just last weekend, my partner and I, peace activists don't go demonstrate at the Naval Air Station in Brunswick, we learned when we move there. You don't go there. Small town, 20,000 people. Everybody kind of knows everybody. You'll kind of create turmoil and conflict if you go protest there. Well, they're involved in the Iraq war. How can we ignore it? So my partner Mary Beth and I last weekend said we were going for a 48-hour vigil and fast at the front gate of the Navy base. And we invited people to come and join us if they'd like. Some didn't come, but some did. We had 45 people come and join us. And what we found, amazingly enough, was that some of the GIs, some of the sailors going into that base, agreed with us, gave us the thumbs up, gave us the peace sign, stopped and talked to us for a little while, encouraged us. Two women officers in uniform stopped their car and said, "I'm with you guys. I'm voting against Bush." Now, who would have ever known that they were there on that base had we not gone there and stirred it up a little bit? And so we've also undertaken in the state of Maine, I'm the chair of the Peace Action Maine Action Committee, and we now have embarked on a campaign we're calling the Sustainable Maine Economy. And we've decided we're going to do a multi-year campaign educating the people of Maine about how military spending is not creating jobs. Now, everybody in Maine is talking about jobs. Jobs are it's like, you know, a distant cousin. They're gone. But people say, well, you know, we got these two big employers in the state. Well, come to find out, the National Commission on Economic Conversion years ago proved that military spending is capital intensive. For $1 million, yes, you create X number of jobs, but if you invest that same $1 million in any other kind of job creation, in every instance, you create more jobs. So if you convert the military-industrial complex to civilian production, you build rail cars for public transportation, solar, wind, windmills. You know where the windmills are built today? In Denmark. Now, why in the hell can't we build windmills in the United States? Right? Doesn't make any sense at all. So we are starting this campaign in the state of Maine to begin to create dialogue in our state about this and create a demand on the politicians over time that we want our tax dollars, because it's all our tax dollars, we want our tax dollars to do something that's going to give our children a real future. So I'd like to just conclude by saying this. I think America has a broken soul. You remember Martin Luther King, right before he was killed, many people believe he was killed because he came out against the war in Vietnam. He said that any country that spends more on weapons and war than it does on social uplift had reached spiritual death. And he was right. America has a broken soul. And it needs a 12-step program real bad. And if we in the peace movement don't start talking about that, and don't start talking about conversion, and don't start talking about America's broken soul and its broken heart. We'll never, ever change anything. Why isn't it that this campaign that's going on now today, instead of talking about Vietnam, why isn't it talking about Iraq? And why isn't this campaign talking about how our tax dollars should really be spent? And how if we were to get out from under the military-industrial complex, we could have a real good future for the future generations. Let's make that happen, friends, and let's don't ever give up. Thank you very much.
Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, speaking on September 16th in Santa Cruz, California. And a couple of community events. Tomorrow, September 27th, Truman's Burg Back to Democracy will meet at the Friends Meeting House in Perry City. The topic will be Democracy in Education, No Child Left Behind. The presentation and discussion will be facilitated by Judy Kugelmass, Associate Professor in the School of Education and Human Development at Binghamton University. The meeting starts at 7 p.m. and is open to all. The Friends Meeting House is located on Route 227, just north of the intersection of Route 228 in Perry City. The group meets regularly every other week for dialogue, educational programs, and to plan common action. And on Saturday and Sunday, October 2nd and 3rd, the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association, in conjunction with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Tompkins County, presents the Green Buildings Open House and Tour. See and discuss solar heating, passive solar, super insulation, salvaged natural and non-toxic building materials, solar hot water, photovoltaic systems, wind power, and much more. There will be guided and self-guided tours. The open house takes place on Saturday and Sunday between the hours of 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. For more information, contact Bill Carini at 564-1025, 564-1025 in the 607 area code, or Tanya Schussler at Cornell Cooperative Extension at 272-2292, 272-2292, or you can visit the website NESEA.org, that stands for Northeast Sustainable Energy Association.org. Our theme music on Welcome Guest is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
Hard by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shining black. Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end, for my guns and